Hello again, I'm Arvin Alney, and this is To The Point. Why does California's second most powerful elected official say the state has fallen behind when it comes to leading the fight against climate change? We'll talk with Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon a bit later on. But first, the one-year anniversary of the assault on the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2001. What's being done to find out what really happened and who was behind it? And what's the state of news coverage 1 year later? On the anniversary itself, President Biden came out swinging against Donald Trump for the very first time.
The former president of the United States of America has created and spread a web of lies about the 2020 election. He's done so because he values power over principle, because he sees his own interest as more important than his country's interest, than America's interest, and because his bruised ego matters more to him than our democracy or our Constitution. He can't accept he lost.
Quinta Jurecic is a writer for The Atlantic, a fellow at Brookings, and a senior editor at Lawfare. That's a website that looks into the law as a weapon of conflict. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Do you think that the president's new, much more aggressive public stance is going to have an impact on the Department of Justice?
It's hard to say. I think that, as you say, it is notable how much more aggressive President Biden was when it came to naming President Trump directly, sort of pointing to him as the cause of so much strife going on right now and as the cause of January 6th, whereas previously he's really framed it in much more abstract language, you know, framing it as a challenge to democracy, but not pointing fingers. I think that change in tone is notable. I'm not sure if I would say it would affect how the Justice Department is handling matters. And what I mean by that is that, you know, so much of what we saw under the Trump administration was President Trump leaning on the Justice Department to do what he wanted, to stop investigations into his friends, to start investigations into his enemies. And that's really not what you want to see in terms of independent law enforcement in a democracy. We want federal law enforcement to be able to begin and end investigations without political pressure. So in one sense, you could say, you know, if the Justice Department changes its approach and becomes more aggressive in response to what President Biden is doing, that might actually be troubling in a way, because we should want Attorney General Garland to, as he said in his own speech, just follow the facts where they lead. It's also true that, you know, the Justice Department has really, is very much at the beginning of what it's doing, and Attorney General Garland has made that point pretty clear, sort of saying that people should expect more to come in terms of its investigations into January 6th. It's hard to say what that could mean. I think there's a broad range of possibilities there. But if, for example, the department unveils some blockbuster charges against, say, the Proud Boys or the Oath Keepers or even associates of President Trump, I'm not sure it would be necessarily right to say that, you know, the department was making that change because of President Biden's change in tone.
Let me ask you this. You wrote recently that both the investigations that are going on, the Department of Justice investigation and the Select Committee, were weirdly static, to use your phrase. What did you mean by that?
January 6th was such an incredibly violent and traumatic and striking moment in our country's history that I think there is a reasonable expectation on the part of the public that, you know, a year out, we would have some really blockbuster charges from the Justice Department, some really blockbuster discoveries made by the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack. And yet, both those investigations have been moving along, but there hasn't been anything that really substantially changes our understanding of what happened on the 6th. The Justice Department is carrying on with bringing charges against and cases against rioters, insurrectionists who were at the Capitol that day. I think we're in the 700s now in terms of the number of cases, which is a pretty unprecedented amount. But as I hinted just now, you know, we haven't seen charges against President Trump or President Trump's associates. We haven't seen the department use really politically charged statutes, like, for example, seditious conspiracy, which was one of the statutes that folks were recommending the Justice Department should use. And then on the committee side, they've sort of been operating a bit under the radar as of late. They had a very prominent hearing in July of 2021 with officers from the Capitol Police and the DC Metropolitan Police Department who were there at the Capitol that day. And since then, they've been engaging in fact-finding. They've been sending out subpoenas, requests for information, but they haven't had any public hearings or issued any reports. That said, that should be changing soon. The committee has said that they're planning for, I think, multiple weeks of hearings in this new year, Ranking Member Liz Cheney has said, and they're planning on also beginning to release reports with their findings. So when I wrote that piece in December of 2021, I think it was true that they were a little static, but it does seem like they're beginning to get a bit of a move on in the public eye.
December of 2021 seems like ages ago, doesn't it? When you in your piece, you talk about expectations and the possibility of having false expectations, since, as you point out, all of this happened, of course, within the public eye. We could see what was going on. And you say that there may never be consensus. Do you think the public hearings might change that?
I think that the public hearings could have a powerful effect in creating a public documentary record of what happened on January 6th, reminding people of things that, you know, perhaps we already knew, but that we have forgotten just as the event has faded a little in memory, and uncovering new information about what happened that day and in the weeks leading up to it. I'm not sure I would go so far as to say that it will lead to broad agreement in the public about what happened, just because the battle lines are pretty clearly drawn. I mean, we have seen that, you know, Republicans on January 6th were very reluctant to condemn the riot, and some of them are outright embracing it and embracing what the insurrectionists did, referring to Ashley Babbitt as a hero, as a martyr. So I think that those political divisions, which have really been sowed by Trump, are not going away anytime soon. And I wouldn't expect the committee to be able to mend those divisions and create a public consensus about what happened. But that doesn't mean that putting forward that record in public isn't valuable work.
Gwenda Jurecik with The Atlantic and Brookings and Lawfare. We'll come back to you in a moment. But first, let's talk a bit about media coverage. The major newspapers, the broadcast networks, CNN, MSNBC, they all call January 6th an insurrection, even a rehearsal for what's to come. And they say that's putting democracy in serious trouble. But Fox News, of course, is quite different. And here's Tucker Carlson on the night of the anniversary.
So looking back, you could probably call what happened on January 6th a riot. We have called it that, but really only just a riot, maybe just barely. By recent standards, it was an embarrassingly tepid effort. No one even bothered to set a fire or spray paint slogans on the walls.
Angelo Carasone is president of Media Matters. That's a web-based monitor of outlets from print to the internet. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Most people watch Fox News. More people watch Fox News, I should say, than CNN or MSNBC. But is the impact of what we just heard from Tucker Carlson even broader than just the audience numbers?
Yeah, without a doubt. Because, you know, to me, I don't think what makes Fox News so pernicious is the audience size itself. It's rather that they have unrivaled agenda setting power and can really build consensus among the Republicans and by extension, the right-wing echo chamber, which can reinforce these false narratives. So in the lead up to January 6th, for example, Fox News, in just the 2 weeks after the election was called for Joe Biden, explicitly challenged the results in 774 individual instances. And that ranges from everything to promoting the theories that the votes had been flipped, that he had, you know, actually lost certain states that were called for him. I mean, the full gamut of conspiracy. So they helped build the scaffolding that then for the attacks on January 6th. And then after, and I think this is the part that we really feel, you know, I agree with that there won't be consensus around this. And in a weird way, the most we ever had consensus about January 6th was on the evening of January 6th and the day after. And that's because the right-wing media, and by extension Fox, hadn't actually started the process of building an alternative narrative and drawing the very battle lines that we've been talking about as a part of this discussion. I mean, they began to attack, even calling it and questioning it as an insurrection about 2 weeks after, and suggested that it was more of a peaceful protest and that perhaps it was left-wing agitators that had done it. So they've spent really a full year sort of elevating all of these different conspiracy theories from the right-wing fever swamps, but I think more importantly, really manufacturing a consensus amongst the larger right-wing echo chamber about, you know, January 6th being mostly overblown sort of Democratic fodder and media sensationalizing.
What do you think is the significance of the involvement of Sean Hannity and others on January 6th itself, calling the White House, calling the chief of staff, and trying to get the president to call it off?
I think that, you know, the Hannity texts and some of the other Fox News figure texts are important because they demonstrate two things. One, that was something that I think has been widely recognized, but it really does sort of put a fine point on it, just how politically active they were with the administration. They sort of saw themselves as a part of the team as opposed to outside, you know, media figures, I mean, which is what they are supposed to be. But I think it's also, it answers another really important question, which is, you know, we always wonder, and I'm always asked or often asked, you know, do they know better? You know, do they believe the things they're saying? And the Hannity text that really illustrates that was on January 5th, where he was saying, I'm really worried about the next couple of days and trying to get them to walk things back and dial down the temperature. The same time that he was texting the administration about his concerns for violence on the 6th, that same day he was promoting the January 6th event. He was hosting Peter Navarro on his radio show, who was characterizing it as akin to when Washington crossed the Delaware during the Revolutionary War, which, if you remember, was a sneak attack. He was promoting it publicly, but privately, what these texts demonstrate is that he certainly did know better. And I think that if this is just the tip of the iceberg, it's going to expose a pretty coordinated effort to sort of muddy the waters and undermine the narrative in the lead up to January 6th, which I think helped build a lot of the momentum and the fuel for that kind of an event.
Let me go back to Quinta Jurassic. What do you think about the involvement of Fox News and about the what was just referred to as the larger right-wing echo chamber? Is there any way to overcome it? And what about the fact that we have Republicans in Congress, leadership in Congress, Mr. McCarthy, McConnell, and others, saying initially that the attacks on the Congress were the president's responsibility and were terrible things, and now backing away?
I think it really emphasizes, and as Angela was saying, that the current Republican embrace of January 6th, or embrace by some, refusal to acknowledge by others, whatever you want to call it, is not something that has always been there. It's easy to sort of look back and think that things were always the way they are now with the Republican Party refusing to condemn the 6th. But of course, as Angela notes, that is not the case. The current situation that we're in is something that was very carefully and manufactured in plain sight. And you can see how as Republicans embrace the 6th, Vice President Mike Pence's popularity, for example, goes down because of his refusal to overturn the certification of the electoral vote. You know, it didn't have to be this way. And I think that that's something that is very striking and very troubling to remember on the anniversary of the 6th. You know, in some ways, we've moved some ways in a good direction, insofar as President Trump is, of course, no longer in the White House. I think there is greater understanding among reporters, among perhaps the Democratic Party, that these threats to democracy are something that need to be taken extremely seriously. But in some ways, we've moved backward in that in the days after the attack, Republicans really were condemning it. And that's no longer something that they feel the need to take the political risk to do.
You talk once again at Peace in December, way back in December, about expectations and whether we are setting ourselves up to be disappointed and whether we need to have what you refer to as realistic expectations. What do you mean by that?
I'm worried that we're setting ourselves up for a trap, the same trap that we fell into with the Mueller investigation, where I think that people had sort of exaggerated ideas of what it was that Mueller would be able to find, that he would be able to uncover completely new information, more information that had been sort of dripped out in news coverage and indictments already about coordination between the Trump campaign and the Russian government, and that it would change the game politically and lead to a wholesale repudiation of Trump by the Republican Party. That obviously didn't happen, and I think there was a lot of frustration and disillusionment with Mueller afterward. I worry that we're starting to go down that same road here, where precisely because January 6th took place fully in the public eye, the details that are remain to be seen, you know, about who was coordinating, to what extent the White House was involved, are extremely important. Don't get me wrong. But the bare facts of it, which is that President Trump egged on a attack on the U.S. Capitol and then refused to call off the attack, have been known since moment one because everyone saw them happening. And so if there is an expectation that the committee will be able to, you know, uncover something even more damning than that, I think that is setting ourselves up for disappointment and possibly even what I'm worried about is political inaction if the committee inevitably can't bring facts more damning than that to play.
Angela Carasone, let's talk a bit about some of those who are thought to have been the architects of this, Steve Bannon particularly. How difficult is it going to be to get them to come forward? And by them, I also mean, of course, the former chief of staff and others associated with the plan that they put into effect. Do you think they ever will? What are your expectations with regard to them?
I think what Quinto was just saying was spot on. And I think it's directly connected to this question because it gets into this point of what are we really going to learn from this committee, from this investigation, and what does that mean about what we can expect? Because I think ultimately it's going to be seen, and I worry a lot about the media treating it like a total failure, or if it doesn't sort of create a really simple understanding of cause and effect, which is just not going to be available. And the way to get a lot of good information about it is going to require some participation, either forced or voluntarily, from these key figures. And then the third vulnerability, and this is what I think the real risk is for people like Steve Bannon and others, is, you know, Bannon is going to fight this in court and in the court of public opinion for at least the next 5 to 6 months. I mean, we're talking about a series of trials and hearings and court dates and court appearances that he's going to go through. Before they even get to, and assuming that the committee is successful, he will have an enormous amount of time between then and now to not just muddy the waters, but to galvanize support and some consensus around the narrative that he's pushing. So it's, you know, on the one hand, we need this information that these individuals have. On the other, there is a real concern that they could actually leverage this for additional media manipulation. And the rest of the news media as a whole, the more these waters get muddied, and I think the characterization of it being battle lines being drawn in the earlier part of the conversation was right, it does create this kind of both sides narrative and begins to feel more akin to politics as usual than something that is reflective of what actually took place on the 6th, which was really distinct, dangerous, and scary. And it begins to move it back into the typical political arena. So if this is going to have any chance of success, the committee and the investigation is going to need to have a real clear, concrete, and tight path to get from here to the information that these few figures have. Steve Bannon, Hannity, or some other Fox figures, I think, are among them because they were so instrumental in the early advisement. And a few other people like Ali Alexander, who were helpful on the ground. And look, some of the members of Congress that were sort of enabling and participating in this. People like Paul Gozer and Jim Jordan, who were actively engaged with some of these figures during that time period. That's going to be important. And if they don't have a path to get even basic information from them until, say, the summer, then it really does, I think, mean we can't expect very much from this. Because even if information does come out that's valuable and relevant at that time, it will necessarily be hyper-politicized and will be too close to the midterms for it to have any real consensus a building effect in the rest of the media conversation.
Bannon has talked to him from time to time about destroying the administrative state, whatever he might mean by that. He's certainly part of what you refer to as the right-wing echo chamber. How does he do it? He has a podcast of his own, but how does that work? How does the information get disseminated from him to others? And how many sites of that kind are there that all sort of pick up the same agenda?
I think, you know, we can work backwards from here, because I think the food chain question and Steve Bannon's role in the food chain and a few others is really important into not just understanding what happened, but also where we go from here. So, you know, last week when Ted Cruz apologized to Tucker Carlson, in that same segment, he did something else, which hasn't gotten as much attention, but I actually think is in some ways more disturbing. He validated a conspiracy theory that the FBI was actually the ones that engaged in January 6th. That initiated it, and that it was a false flag operation. He gave some credence to that in their discussion with Tucker Carlson. And the reason so now you have a senator who is beginning to validate something that was percolating in the fever swamps. And that one small example actually speaks to the influence that somebody like Bannon has. Because if you work it backwards, Tucker Carlson picked up that conspiracy theory a few months ago, and it was featured in a documentary that he did for Fox News about January 6th. And if you continue to say, well, where did that come from? Well, it actually came from Steve Bannon's podcast, which has more than 125 million downloads at this time. It has a fairly engaged and passionate audience, even if it's not super big because this has been removed from YouTube. And he has been pounding the drum on that one very specific claim that there was an FBI plant inside the events, inside the protest that day, and that it was actually the FBI that had coordinated the original rush to the Capitol and sort of convincing all the others to do it, and that it was a setup to make Donald Trump look bad, sort of revenge for Trump going after the deep state, as they would say, for so long when he was in office. And so that is and I can walk through dozens of other examples where these sort of kernels or these ideas are germinated in the right-wing fever swamps, whether it be online or in some of these message board communities or other extremist groups. They get picked up in places like Steve Bannon and a few other programs. Alex Jones is one of them. Then you have others that are more mainstream, but are still in the same category, like Dan Bongino's, which has a fairly prominent radio footprint. And they sort of simmer there for sometimes months before a person at Fox News, Fox News really does have that ability to elevate it to a whole new level and then have it reverberate back through the right-wing echo chamber, picks it up, does a series on it, does a segment on it, begins to give it more credence, which in turn then means that the rest of the talk radio ecosystem talks about it, the rest of the online echo chamber talks about it, and that is an illustration of that. So Steve Bannon is a key part of this because he has, to your point, an intention. It is to destroy, and it's a lot easier to tear down. That means that you don't have to be consistent. You just have to keep hammering away. And that is a big part of what his program is designed to do, which is to sort of put as much of this stuff out there. He says, you know, flood the zone. And that is what his program is basically functioning as right now, sort of a petri dish for a whole range of conspiratorial and extremist attacks, some of which will break through, make their way up the food chain, and then reverberate back through the rest of the right-wing echo chamber.
So who's Ray Epps, by the way, since you are a senator? Like, he and this other guy are clearly encouraging the crowd to commit crimes. Neither one has been arrested or charged. What is that, do you think?
So I think that is a very good question. I don't know who Ray Epps is. I've seen that video multiple times. It's disturbing.
Right?
He's clearly urging the crowd to violate the law. When you see the crowd start chanting, Fed, 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 for him to appear on the FBI's most wanted list and come off, it certainly suggests he was working for the FBI. That's not conclusive, but that's the obvious implication.
Quinta Jurassic, let me go back to you. How serious is it when a senator as powerful as Ted Cruz, there are only 100 of them after all, and he wants to be a presidential candidate, when he endorses an idea as bizarre and unrealistic as the false flag theory that Tucker Carlson has been pushing.
I think it shows where the power is on the right currently, that, you know, this isn't a situation where a senator is more powerful than Tucker Carlson, who's one of Fox's marquee hosts. It's clearly Carlson who is setting the agenda, and who, as Angela said, is sort of helping put out these completely false narratives out there about what happened on January 6th and what was really going on. I think that that clip was so striking for a number of reasons, but one of them was that it just showed in, you know, less than 5 minutes, the current political dynamics of the Republican Party, where elected members of Congress just feel that they are completely at the mercy of people who are spewing falsehoods and who are making others believe in falsehoods.
So you say at the end of your piece of last month, documenting the truth is one thing. Figuring out whether people want to listen is another. Is the public, do you think, paying attention?
It's a great question. I will confess that I haven't looked at the polling on this issue, so I'm not completely sure. But, you know, over the last 5 or 6 years now, we've continually had these arguments about, you know, does the public care more about the state of democracy or more about kitchen table issues, the state of the pocketbook, that kind of thing. I think that President Biden, so far at least, has very clearly knit those two things together in arguing explicitly at times that what we really need to do in order to save democracy is to show that democracy can provide for people, can allow them to live, you know, dignified, meaningful lives, can allow their children to be better off than they were. And so therefore, you know, he focused on the infrastructure bill and on this social policy bill that's currently being hashed out between Congress and the White House. I think the bigger question is to what extent there's an appetite in the public for, you know, this high altitude discussion of sort of democracy qua democracy and the threats that we face. And I don't think that there's, you know, there's no one answer to that, in part because, of course, there's no way to remove all of the variables. When we talk about what the public is interested in, we're talking about a public whose interest is conditioned by the news that people read, the news that people have time to read, you know, what their elected representatives and the people they trust in the media and elsewhere suggest is important and that they should pay attention to. And so, well, it's not a complete answer to say, you know, build it and they will come, cover this issue and people will pay attention to it. I do think that it's important to cover this issue and give it as much attention as it needs to send out that signal to, you know, the many, many busy people who don't have time to focus on this all day, that this is something that they should care about.
So, Angela Corazon, again, you're president of Media Matters, and you pay attention to who's saying what and who's listening. Is it possible that we could have some form of accountability from either the Attorney General or the Special Committee or both and still not have it matter?
I think that's very possible. In fact, it could even have a backlash. And that's not a reason not to do it, but it actually is a reflection of where we are right now. So when people talk about, and there's some of the discussion about the sort of the perilous or fragile state that our democracy in, that our society is in, that is to me an indicator of that. That when we start to think about accountability for wrongdoing, we have to factor in the political considerations because of the concerns about a right-wing backlash or a backlash. And that's a reality. And that's real. You know, I always think about it in the context of COVID and public health, because here's something that was entirely non-political. And you can do a thought experiment where you can imagine a place right now where if in the beginning of the pandemic, Fox News and the right-wing media were not calling it a hoax, where for 2 months in the spring, they weren't promoting hydroxychloroquine as a magic cure for the disease. And if they weren't so active in promoting and discouraging people from taking the vaccinations, I mean, our public health response would look and feel very different because we would at least be operating from the same page as opposed to a hyper-partisan response. And that, to me, gets to where we go, because I think even if there is these moments or flashpoints of accountability, they will be marred by the rest of the right-wing echo chamber that will make it seem like it's hyper-ideological, that it was done purely for political purposes, and it will incentivize, could be exploited to incentivize and fuel a further violent backlash. And again, that's not a reason not to do it, but it is, to me, the reason why all this matters so much. It's not purely a function of disagreements or ideas about a policy. It actually, this conversation is really about how stable of a footing are we on, and what does that mean? Because I think for most people, it feels so unimaginable to think about a deterioration and decay in some basic things that we've taken for granted. But we don't have to imagine it anymore. We actually just need to listen to what some of these very prominent people are saying. I mean, there are talk radio personalities like Hannity, for example, that have 15, 16 million listeners. And every day he is telling his people that that Biden is not the president, that it was stolen from him, and that they need to start thinking about doing something about it. And that same narrative exists in a very large part of the country right now. And so do I think it would have a big effect on the margins? No. I think what matters a lot and why we should continue to do it is because there is a whole bunch of people in the middle, like most Americans, that only think about politics 4 days a week, that we all need to at least recognize that what took place on the 6th was not an anomaly. It could become the norm, and that there may be the need for some accountability for it. But I think more importantly, there's actually a bigger need and a broader need for a lot of prevention and awareness that this is being fueled and driven by a large part of our information ecosystem that is solely designed to do, as Steve Bannon says, tear it all down.
We talked about the power of Tucker Carlson with respect to Ted Cruz. Tucker Carlson spent a week in Hungary, broadcasting out of Hungary, and more or less advocating the policies of Orban, the leader in Hungary, who has been an autocrat of sort of a definitive kind. Quinta Jurecic, how worried are you about democracy in the United States?
Well, that's a big question. I would say worried. That's not particularly descriptive. If you had to ask me on a 1 out of 10 scale, where 10 is hair on fire, I would say maybe a 7 or an 8. I don't think that we're necessarily, you know, going to see some kind of a violent overthrow. I think it's important to be clear about what it is that we mean when we say worried about democracy. What I mean is that there is a substantial portion of the population of this country, many of whom voted for Trump, who are not interested in seeing many of their fellow citizens as full members of a democracy whom they want to share power with. And that divides, obviously, along racial lines, that there is a real rejection of multiracial democracy among a certain faction of this country. And unfortunately, our electoral institutions, our governmental institutions are designed in such a way that that group of people have outsized voice, outsized power, and that it will be very hard to break up that coalition and to oust it from power. So I think the thing to be afraid of is not, you know, some vision of a violent coup or January 6th part two where, you know, Trump is imposed as forever leader, not something like that, but rather just this slow creep of autocracy eating away at what democracy really should be, which is equality and dignity among citizens and the genuine possibility of self-government, which includes, as President Biden says, you know, loving your country even when you lose, and all parties accepting that they can legitimately lose.
Okay, we've touched on a lot of subjects. As the investigations go forward, the attorney generals and the special committees as well. This has been sort of an introductory way of looking at what's going to happen next. And we only have to wait and see. Quinta Jurecic again with the Atlantic, Brookings, and Lawfare. Thanks to you. Thanks to Angelo Corazon, the president of Media Matters. Great to have you both. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In a moment, we'll talk with Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon on California's failing leadership on climate change. This is To the Point.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. The state legislature is back in session in a year when every assembly seat and a third of the Senate will be up for election. We don't know yet the impact of reapportionment, but two things are certain. Democrats will continue to run the show, and climate change will be on the agenda. Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon is denying rumors that he'll bow out before he's termed out just 2 years from now. And he made big news at last month's COP26 International Climate Conference in Scotland, saying that California has lost its leadership role. During the holiday break, I asked him what he meant.
I think our cap and trade program is, you know, has probably been our landmark proposal here in California, and we established aggressive 2030 goals, but. Even there, I mean, we're in terms of reducing our emissions by 40% below 1990 levels, and we're not on track to do that. You could argue that those goals aren't even aggressive enough, yet those goals that I think are quite modest are goals that we're not even on track to achieve. I think that says a lot about where we need to be and how quickly we need to get there as a state.
Why aren't we on track? What's happened?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, first of all, we've learned, whether it's through UN studies or universities throughout the world, we've learned that the crisis is moving much more quickly than we thought it was. We always thought this was a dire situation, and the sad reality is it's far more dire than we thought. At the same time, the science aside, the political realities are, whether it's, you know, offsets, whether it's breaking from our antiquated fueling sources, we still have fallen short on a lot of policy in a lot of policy areas.
What are the major things we ought to be doing?
I think we need to decrease our dependence on fossil fuels, and at some point end our dependence on fossil fuels. I think that's something that we have said we wanted to do in the past, and we don't seem to be moving forward at a quick enough pace.
Now, that's long-term thinking, but what about short-term measures? In Scotland, it was announced that California will be admitted to the Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance. That's a big deal internationally, but only on a provisional basis. That's because Governor Newsom has refused to ban new oil and gas drilling. In fact, he's approved more than 5,000 new wells, mostly in communities already burdened by the worst pollution. And I asked Rendon about that.
As you may recall, Warren, I came from a career 15, 20 years in early childhood education in East and Southeast Los Angeles County. Those are the things that get in the lungs of kids, particularly in places like Southern California, but also places like Latin America. We met with a delegation in India, and we know that's a crisis there too. These are the things that get into the lungs of young kids and adults alike, and cause so many of the respiratory problems. These are chemicals that we see that emanate from factories and industries from throughout Southern California. These have to be at the top of our priorities in terms of addressing.
The sources of them are said to be primarily organic waste and wildfires and diesel fuel, all very different things. Would you advocate one or another proposal to deal with those things individually?
Yeah, so we have done so. We've made great efforts in all of those areas. But again, it's just like the overall idea of climate change. It's something we need to be more aggressive about. So I think some of the COGs in Southern California are great examples of that. You've seen similar efforts in places like the Inland Empire and also in the Central Valley. What's interesting and sometimes challenging for the cities in my district, places like Maywood, places like Bell, places like Cudahy, is for those cities to be situated, you know, alongside a giant like the city of Los Angeles and its 4 million residents, makes it very difficult from the standpoint of trying to access resources. It makes it very difficult from the standpoint of just sheer politics in terms of sort of sheer numbers. So I think, sort of organizing and sort of pooling their resources is something that these cities have learned to do as a mode of survival. And I think it's really starting to bear fruit in a lot of different ways.
So the changing population is changing political power?
Yeah, I think the sheer demographic shift of the state necessitates that we have those conversations. I think the communities, certainly the communities that I represent, and it's also analogous to some of the other communities that I talked about a little earlier in the Inland Empire, in the Central Valley, which have large Latino populations. Those communities have very, very different experiences than some of our coastal communities. And it's incumbent upon us as a democracy. It's incumbent upon us to listen to those voices and to make sure those voices are heard.
Well, do they have the power that they need now? And are they beginning to exert more power by virtue of banding together in the way that you suggest and taking advantage of the demography?
Yeah, they're beginning to. Do they have the power they need? No. That's the reality. The reality is that, you know, so whether it's foundation dollars or corporate headquarters or, you know, corporate philanthropy, there's still a concentration of capital in the big cities and the coastal areas and a lot of communities inland, whether it's inland in the county of Los Angeles or inland within the state, have been ignored. But having these coalitions of smaller entities and of Latino communities is certainly moving things in the right direction.
So now, once again, at COP26, the speaker said California's lost its leadership when it comes to climate change. Governor Newsom canceled plans to attend the conference. Former secretaries of California's Environmental Protection Agency and the Air Resources Board have said those agencies aren't doing enough about those short-term pollutants we talked about earlier. So I asked, what about Newsom's commitment?
The governor is very committed to these issues, whether it's climate, whether it's clean air. I remember sitting at the governor's swearing in and smelling smoke from nearby forest fires. You go from that to mudslides to COVID. He has encountered one natural or human-made disaster after another, I think. And also, I think a rather cynical recall effort that he had to weather as well. The governor's attention has been, he's had to sort of divert his attention to a lot of crises and has done a great job. But at the same time, I know his long-term goals include wanting to focus on climate and clean air, and I know he's going to do that in the future.
Do you want to see more from the ARB and the Energy Commission?
Yes, I'd like to see more from both of those entities.
One more question. I know that you're out of time, but very quickly, there's been a lot of talk about not closing Diablo Canyon, the nuclear power plant, after all, but rather keeping it going. What's your take on that?
I think it's time to close Diablo. I think closing it makes sense. But at the same time, we know that we need to to offset that that energy from somewhere. So when we go to a place like Scotland and look at their offshore wind efforts, those are the types of things that we need to do to make sure that we're making up for the loss of Diablo.
Anthony Rendon, the Speaker of the California State Assembly, thank you so very much for giving us so much time. Much appreciated.
Thanks, Warren.
Now, we'll be looking at new climate proposals, of course, coming from the Speaker, from the Governor, and from others as well as this election year legislative session goes forward. And, of course, it's a very important one. The producer of To the Point is Andrea Brody, with assistance from Anna Buss. Our engineer is John Meek. We'd love to hear from you. Leave us a review. We want to get your input. Thanks for being with us this time. Join us again.